What's up? I'm Tyler.
And I'm Dakota.
And this is the Bourbon and Business Podcast,
where we interview successful businessmen and women to let you in on why success doesn't have a single formula to follow.
We also have a little bourbon tasting along the way, because why not?
So guys, please enjoy this episode and let us know your thoughts at Bourbon and Business Podcast on Instagram.
Coming to you from the Bourbon and Business Studio here in the Capitol Club in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. I'm Tyler.
And I'm Dakota.
And this is the Bourbon and Business Podcast. How you doing this morning, Dakota?
Very well, Tyler. How are you?
I'm doing great. Excited about this episode.
Yeah,
and
me
excited
too.
About this bourbon.
Yeah.
Well, you want to tell our listeners a little bit about the Capitol Club?
Yeah, the Capitol Club is the event space in downtown Jackson, in the Jackson Metro, really. You get panoramic views of the Jackson skyline. It's beautiful, fantastic, it's spacious, it's elegant. They've got it all here, Tyler. What else am I missing?
I mean, they do lunch here daily. They have event space. So if you're looking to book a wedding or a social event, this is the place to do it. No better views in Jackson. So check them out online, Capitol Club, Jackson, Mississippi. And you want to introduce our guest to us this morning?
I do. Today we have special guest Karen Ranz. She is president of Cougarrand Capital Holdings, also host of a podcast, The Compassionate Capitalist Show. Best-selling author of Inside Secret to Angel Investing. She's got quite a rap sheet here.
Yeah, doing it all, so.
Good deal.
Well, Karen, we appreciate you coming on this morning.
I'm excited to be on this show because, you know, not only do I like bourbon, but I also like business, so what a perfect match.
Yeah, no better combination.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally in our name, bourbon and business.
Yeah. Well, what are we sipping on today, Dakota?
We've got Legendary Duke here. I think there's a word after Duke, but I'm not even going to try to read it. It's in, like, really scripted cursive. Somebody out there is probably like, oh, my gosh, what a dummy. It's this word. But it's a Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. Let's see. It's made in 2021, and it is a 88 proof. So very low proofing here. But what do you think?
Well, I'm going to give it a double rating. So from a bourbon standpoint, amazing. One of the best that we've had on the podcast, which that's all that matters. So I'm going to give them probably a 9.6.
Oh, wow.
So very strong rating. I do like this bourbon. Now, with that being said, I've never had this happen before in all my years of drinking bourbon. The cork on here, I'm going to have to give it a 0.5.
Oh, man.
So it was like we were trying to break into a bank to get this bourbon open.
That is true.
We had to pull a wine cork deal. I mean, what do you call that? Wine opener out.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that was rough. I've never had a cork top just pop off like that. It was the top was like glued to the actual cork part, and so when I twisted it to pop it off, it just broke.
Yeah. But good bourbon, great bourbon.
So yeah. So,
strong rating.
Like you said, that's what matters, right? It's what's inside, not the outside. That's very true of you.
Well, Karen, we appreciate you coming on today. We always like to start this, kind of give us your background, where you grew up, and then how you got into the many different things that you're into today. So,
like a lot of folks, my parents split when I was little, and I didn't really know my dad other than phone calls and letters until I was a teenager, since my dad lived on the West Coast in California. I was born in Santa Monica, and my mom and I lived in Florida over in Jacks Beach. My mom worked in education, and my dad was a small business owner. He was an engineer and invented many things. You know, the one that generated his success was he invented the first multicolor screen printing device. You know how T-shirts have multiple colors on it? Before he invented this device, you see him at lots of shows, you could only do two or three colors, and he did six colors. So that was, and then he went on to manufacture the equipment and sell it. And there's a whole long story on that. But, you know, they ponder sometimes, people say, like, are entrepreneurs born or bred? For me, it was really both, I thought, because as I came to understand more about the things my dad went through to start his business, it really inspired me in one of my darkest times to start the Compassionate Capitalist Movement, which is, you know, what my show is named on. And I threw myself fully into this idea of being the catalyst to bring more investors into the market and fund startups and smart businesses and bring the potential for greater wealth, really for investors of all ages, of all types, incomes, everything that can participate in, you know, creating wealth besides just stocks and real estate. you know, the way millionaires have for, you know, in secret for 80 years until the Jobs Act of 2012. But when I was in high school, and my high school was really like that Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I mean, literally, it was three blocks from the beach. And the guys would stand across the street and smoke who knows what before they skipped school and went to the beach, right? But, you know, that wasn't my story. I was, you know, the good little girl in high school. But, you know, I remember in hindsight being inspired by some, I don't know, movie or TV character thinking, you know, I want to be that person that travels the world advising companies about what businesses to buy and where to expand. I actually kind of had this idea, you know, I think it might have been from, what was that TV show back in the 80s, Dynasty or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was like something like that, right? And so when I was ready to go off to college, I looked at a bunch of places and I settled on Emory University in Atlanta because one, it was a big city and I needed to get out of Jacksonville. And two, it got me away from my high school mates that mostly went to FSU in Tallahassee or UF in Gainesville or some kind of community college. And I was going to discover myself. And three, they gave me money to go there. So, you know, great, right? Let's go, Hotlanta. And then the funny thing happened. I did so much educating myself, I almost flunked out my freshman year. And you ever heard, don't let your books get in the way of your education? Well, that was me full on, right? So I buckled down though and graduated with an economics and English degree because it seemed sort of business adjacent. And the consensus was at the time that you don't go straight from undergrad business to MBA school. And I had thought that doing a combination of business school and law school would be the way for me to do this thing where I was going to travel the world and advise companies and all that stuff. So I could be that worldly advisor, you know? And the funny thing about bad grades in college, it makes it hard to get into post-grad. And so although I did, you know, I did well enough to get into a bunch of different MBA programs and a bunch of different law schools, none of them were together, right? So there's no way to do the combination. And my mom was a alma mater from the University of Florida, so I decided to go there. And I was going to start there and then get my law degree afterwards. And after the first year of school, I was like, the heck with this. I am done with school. It's time to go get a job and make some money.
Yeah.
And I met my husband, who I've now been married to 35 years. And so we did that whole, you know, start our lives together back up in Atlanta. But while I was at MBA school, I started selling Apple computers at a dealership there. And that was when, you know, not to age myself too much, but it was when the Macintosh first came out. So, right? And so I really wanted to get a job at IBM. They came to campus looking for, you know, to hire off of campus, the MBA school. And I really wanted to get a job at IBM so I could leverage getting a job at Apple because I wanted to work at Apple. And the summer before my senior year in college, right, before I went to grad school, my girlfriend and I road tripped across the country to the West Coast in Los Angeles for the Summer Olympics. And spent the summer out there, and my dad had a place for us. And it was the summer of love, I tell you. It's a good thing my daughter doesn't do the same kind of things I did back then, because you can't get away with that anymore. It's a lot more dangerous out there. Anyway, we slept one night. We went into across the border and came back and slept on the beach in San Diego, wow, less than a mile from the border. It's like a little crazy stuff. Anyway, a guy that I dated that summer worked for IBM. So I called him, and I said, how'd I get a job at IBM? And he, like, gave me a bunch of things to talk about, you know, computer lingo stuff, because I didn't know what DOS was, disk operating system. Apple didn't use that stuff. And so I'm interviewing with this job, and I think I got the job more than – I got a job with IBM. I didn't get a job with Apple, but I think I got the job at IBM because I knew as much about SEC football and could talk shop with – this guy, because I saw the pictures of him at football games, and I was like talking, you know, SEC, like we live and breathe with football down here, right? And so I think he hired me as much for that as he did for my computer knowledge. And so that was when IBM was launching the PS2, OS2. Like, y'all ever even heard of that stuff? Y'all are a little younger than me, but it doesn't really matter, because I went on from there to have about 8 jobs and 10 managers in 13 years while I was at IBM. It was a crazy time of, you know, with them ups and downs and competition was eating their lunch. And, you know, but it was great for me because a lot of what my jobs were was bringing new products to market, creating whole new businesses involved in mobile and wireless. And when the Olympics came to Atlanta, I had been working on the OS2 team, and I recruited this app developer to develop a tool set for doing PIN OS2. So so you could write on a tablet, because IBM had tablets back then. And they ended up using it to keep the stats for basketball and volleyball and different things at the Olympics. Like, it was like a, you know, they do the court, you know, if you've ever been around basketball and the stats, right? You put X's and circles and stuff. And so they used this tool that I had convinced this guy. So, you know, there was a lot of fun being a part of creating products that you didn't even know there was a way to solve some of those problems. And so then my last job there, my title was called Complex Opportunity Business Manager. My nickname was the Deal Maker, because as a senior rep, I was helping young frontline sales reps sell to the .coms or recruit .coms as customers, and software companies that were called click and mortar back then, the precursor to online stores. And, you know, people going into what we call the cloud now, you know, back then it was, you know, it wasn't called software as a service. And my job was to evaluate their tech and their business model, give them the IBM seal of approval, get them the resources and equipment to spend it with, to go out and get venture capital so they could come back and spend it with IBM, right? IBM had missed out on the eBays and Amazons and things like that, so they wanted to get in on some of these. They figured out this was the way to go about doing it. And so I had a customer that was incredible software that had, he was a very difficult man, but like, he was my customer and he needed what I was giving him, you know, from IBM. So he would listen to me. And I learned one of my first lessons. I left IBM to go help him get capital and then, you know, take him to market, right? And I learned one of the first lessons of raising capital is that if the entrepreneur is a stubborn, you know what? Nobody wants to give them money. Okay.
That's imagine that. One.
Yeah.
No matter how good the product is or what problem they're solving. So that's number one. It took me a minute to figure out. And the other thing that was a problem with that is that I did this in 2000. So in my bubble of IBM, I did not know there was a .com bubble going on. I just wanted to get in that parade and not watch that parade go by because it was so exciting, all the new stuff that was coming out. And so y'all remember the movie Animal House, right? And at the end, they're in that parade and they go down into the dead end alley and they're all banging into the wall, you know, bumping into the wall. Well, that was the parade I chose to get in January of 2000. It took me a minute to figure it out. But along the way, I got invited to my first angel investor group. And about a few months in, and I said, well, I go check this out. What is this angel investor group? Because it didn't really dawn on me until more recently, after I'd written the book and everything, that I had never heard of that term angel investor until I walked into that room. It was like, you know, in a way, it was almost like walking into this secret society, because it was all these kids, mostly men at that time, that were picking and choosing the companies they were going to put money in that had the potential to, you know, go big, right? And so, but it was fascinating to me because it was so logical that there was money between, you know, a startup idea and the banks and the VCs. I just had never heard about it before. And so I was there to scout it for this guy. And also I had been started the Bird Dog for sort of like a quasi VC firm. And, you know, that was sort of set the trajectory, because we couldn't raise, I didn't raise him any money. The firm, the venture capital firm, it imploded because of 9/11, quite frankly. But in the meantime, the guy that had started that angel group, Jerry Martin, wanted to retire, and he wanted somebody to take it over, and he started mentoring me and teaching me, you know, about how to run these events, how to screen the companies. I started interviewing and talking, and I'd be hanging out with these angels, and it was like, how'd you get started? Why'd you invest in this deal? Why didn't you invest in that deal? And one of the things that I learned was that they, most angel investors at that time, there really wasn't any training. And so they learned by losing money. And I thought, that's a horrible way to learn money, lose money, right?
It's a tough way to learn.
Something. It's like, oh, let me lose 50 grand and then I'll kind of figure this thing out. You know, I mean, you have to have such fortitude to want to like be this type of investor. It was like, and as I later on, as I unpacked that, I was like, that was where compassionate capitalists came from, because they want to make money. That's the capitalist side of it. But the passion, sharing a passion for what that company is doing and choosing to put your money to work as a compassionate capitalist instead of just transactional buying and selling of stocks or real estate, really made the difference. And it was that passion that helped me to understand why millionaires that can invest in anything choose to invest in entrepreneurs, because they believe in what they're doing. It gives them a sense of purpose and what their money's going to, creating jobs, solving a problem, and making money. So, you know, that's my story. That was kind of the, you know, the windy road. One door closes, another door open, and there you are.
Well, and for our listeners that maybe, because you spoke to this, you had never heard the term angel investor, explain to our listeners what an angel investor is.
Okay, so for a traditional sense, a definition of angel investor, sort of like by the SEC laws, right, it's based off of certain income. So double income, like two household income of two incomes, $450,000, the single income, about $300,000 for the last 3 years of earned income, and then net worth of $1 million, not including your primary residence. So that's like the financial definition. The term angel investor actually came from back in the 1930s, and it was really from plays, people sponsoring plays and putting money into theater, and they were angels, but they were also the wealthy people that were, you know, working in each other's businesses, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Gettys, and all that kind of stuff. And that's sort of where it generated. And now it's sort of a broad term, and it's hard because people are like, crowdfunding investors is kind of a tongue twister. And, you know, angels don't like to think of themselves as the crowdfunding investors. But to me, it's sort of all of the above. We're sort of in this mix. But they're the people that put their own personal money into an entrepreneur, usually buying shares of that company before they go public, or they can provide it as bridge financing. They can provide in my book, I have a chapter on when an investor's a bank providing, you know, loans to businesses that can't get it from a bank as a short-term thing, as a way to make money. There's, you know, all different ways that investors can play that fall under the umbrella of angel investors.
Okay. Well, and tell us, so we got your story up to the point that I guess that you went off and started your current business that you have now. Tell our listeners a little bit about your business and y'all's operations.
So back when I was running the Angel Investor Group, it slowly under Jerry, it had kind of died down a little bit. I ended up, when I took it over for real, I rebuilt it to be one of the top in the Southeast and top 50 in the U.S., and we were doing monthly dinners where companies would pitch, and then we would do big private equity conference called the Southeast Private Equity Conference that 20 some odd companies would pitch, and there would be hundreds of investors in the room, and all of that was great. We were like, wonderful things were happening, and then the Great Recession happened, and it like just threw cold water on everything, because I figured out all of my investors that were in my group, only one or two of them had sold a company as an entrepreneur that made their money. Most of them were people working in their corporate jobs or were partners in a company or owned a small business, and they were also investing in other companies. Kind of like if y'all know Robert Kiyosaki and the cash flow quadrant, mm-hmm. right side of the quadrant, right? You'd be a business owner and you invest your money, right? So that's what they were doing. So when the Great Recession happened and people needed to man their own businesses and make sure they didn't go down, they still had the money, but they didn't have the time to be putting into looking at these deals. So we trudged along, hoping that it would turn around and, you know, a little thing sideways. Ultimately, I sunset that group. The Jobs Act came out in 2012, which made it legal for anybody, well, entrepreneurs to raise capital. So let me explain a little bit about the illegal side of this. So, because it's really important to understand the significance of the Jobs Act. Prior to the Jobs Act, entrepreneurs could only go raise capital from people they knew that were already millionaires, or they could go through these angel groups, and that would be their passage. They were given permission, even though they didn't know the people in that angel group, to raise capital that way. And that's sort of like the pipeline of angel investor to VC, right? So that's the reason why so many companies struggled to raise capital for so long, right? If you weren't a tech company, it was almost impossible to raise capital. And so with the Jobs Act, they wanted to get, banks weren't loaning money, and they wanted to get more access to capital. And they saw that reward-based crowdfunding had worked really well, and that there was a lot of technology that had come to market that we kind of take for granted now. Smartwatches, drones, 3D printers, you know, VR headsets, they all came to market with reward-based. So somebody would throw $1,000 in to get a watch early, right? But then what happened a couple of years later, you know, those companies would go off and raise millions of dollars, even sell their company for hundreds of millions of dollars. And what did that person have? They had an old obsolete widget gadget that they had bought under reward base, nothing else. But had they put $1,000 in, they might have $10,000. So once every once in a while, our government works well. And in this case, the Jobs Act worked really well. It's just that they're not very good at marketing. Government doesn't know how to market. And so few people still don't know about it. But it gave a way for entrepreneurs to raise capital in multiple ways in their state, across the country, little amounts, large amounts, startups to growth stage, like all kinds of ways to raise capital legally and solicit for it. So I could send out postcards. I can tweet on it or X on it, whatever. I can do social media. I can do advertisements. I can solicit to investors that come and like what I do, not just through these narrow gauntlets. That's called general solicitation. But it also meant that any investor, regardless of their income, there's certain limits on how much they can invest based on their income, can invest in those companies too. So the idea was it was the great economic democratization of the capital markets. And so it was going to be everybody could play and everybody could, you know, leap the wealth gap and play in the game the way highly successful tech companies and millionaires have for a long time. And so my biggest fear at the time when that was coming out is that all these, because I knew how hard it was, and I didn't want people like all these other investors that I had been working with to learn by losing. So that was, I mentioned my dad. So my dad was dying, and I was there going through all of his materials. And I saw that business that had created his wealth, he didn't start till he was 50 years old. And so I was like, oh, wow, life's not over. My dad had his greatest set part of his life. You know, he had been a great engineer and stuff like that before, but this part that gave him the greatest joy at starting at 50. So, you know, there was hope for me, even though I was like really blue. This is my darkest time because this vision of what I had had, I was going to do with my angel group and stuff like that, it all just imploded. And so I set out to write this book, Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, and it's pretty robust. It's 300 pages, but 100 of that is a glossary. And so, you know, as a primer, would you, should you, could you, how would you do it if you wanted to become an investor in entrepreneurs or small businesses, startups, whatever. And so, you know, the nature of things, you think, you know, build it and they will come. If I named the book, this is where I realized that people didn't know about angel investing like I did when I left IBM. If I named the book, How to Invest in a Company Before They Get Really Big and Go Public or Get Bought and Make Money Doing It, you know, that might have been, you know, an actual great title, but it would be really hard on the cover because it'd be a whole lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody was looking for books on angel investing because they didn't know what it was. So I rebooted the podcast to be my infomercial to talk about that. I interviewed VCs and angels and things like that. And now I just launched my digital course that actually takes people step by step, really handholding them through the process to build their own angel profitability blueprint. And I work with companies that are raising capital under these direct public offerings and help them figure out why they're struggling to raise capital under my company name, Cougarand Capital Holdings. And I help investors do due diligence, learn how to invest, be better, just, you know, really creating the ecosystem of what I call compassionate capitalism.
Yeah. You touched on one thing there. You know, you said your dad, obviously he was successful before in his career, but he didn't find his passion until he was 50. And I think that's a big thing for our listeners to hear that, you know, that, cause we do hear from a lot of our listeners that they're stuck in a job they're not happy with, trying to find a career that they're happy in, and that it's, you know, at the right time, if you're doing the right things, it will happen. You just got to make sure that you're putting the work in.
You got to be opportunistic too. Right. You know, you've got to be ready to pounce when the iron's hot. You know,
right.
A lot of people are kind of like, well, I'm just, you know, kind of going through and I don't necessarily like what I'm doing, but you know, I'd like to do something else. Well, have you thought about what you like to do? You know, if that opportunity presents itself, you've never even given it a second thought, then you're not going to know when it's time to jump. So you're going to miss that opportunity. Who knows how many you've already missed before because you haven't ever taken the time to actually think about it.
Sure. And one thing so that intrigues me, so it's join the compassionate capitalist movement, the compassionate portion of that. I'm assuming there's something that happened to bring that about. Where did that come from?
Well, I had been calling myself that all along, but, you know, when we were going through the Great Recession, my podcast at the time was called Spec Talk Radio for the big conference, Southeast Private Equity Conference. And when I saw all my investors had their money sitting on the sidelines And I was like, the way that we can have the greatest impact on our economy and make it really, really strong is to fund these organizations, these groups, these entrepreneurs that are creating the new jobs. And so I renamed it Compassionate Capitalist. And my definition was really long at the time, but it's Compassionate Capitalist, somebody who invests time, knowledge, resources, and money into entrepreneur endeavors, bring innovation to the market, create jobs, and create wealth for all those involved. That's a mouthful. So then I had to sort it down, and I'm, you know, I kind of simple. It's like, well, when I understood that they're investing in companies that they share the passion of what it there is doing. And in the book, they told me I had to create a story. Everybody likes a story. They don't want just all this stuff, right? So there was an investor that had come in. It's kind of funny story. I was at a networking thing in Buckhead here in Atlanta. It was really, really crowded. And, this guy saw my card, Angel Investing, and he was like, what's that? And I said, and we ended up standing up on top of the couch, and we could hear each other at this thing, and we're up on this couch, and I was explaining to him that it's when you put some of your money into multiple companies that you really like what they're doing, and you want to see them become successful, and then you share their financially that same success. And he was an executive in a company, he was the CEO of a company, almost like what you kind of talked about. He was bored with his job. There was no way for him to, you know, go on up unless he went overseas because it was a foreign-owned company. And he, at his age, he wasn't quite 50 yet. He had kids in middle school and stuff. He didn't want the, like, he wasn't sure. He wanted to go try to get a job at another company. And he was talking to his financial planner about, oh, should I, like, leave and start a company? Should I buy a company? What should I do? I'm just bored. Like, I'm stuck. I'm just stuck. Right? And when he came into my group, he understood. He could keep his day job, have all the perks, be able to go play golf at 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday. He could take the big vacations. He could do all that kind of stuff. And he could find the passion for a problem and solve it with somebody that's willing to work even harder than he is because that person invented it. That person is really, really passionate about trying to solve that problem. And all you got to do is give them some money. So you can put money in, and yeah, it's, you know, there's some risk associated with that, but not near as risky as being the entrepreneur that's starting the company. And sure. So, you know, when he figured that out, it was so funny when we invested in this company that it's really all the rage now because it's totally caught up on stuff, but it was RFID tags that were really intelligent that didn't have to be connected to the cloud, and they could store a phone book worth of data rather than a business card worth of data. And they were in town. I remember they came back in town to give us an update. And the swagger, he brought one of his VPs in, and he became an investor. And like all these investors were just, you could just see they had like this lilt in his step. He was no longer like, oh, I'm just like getting stuck in this job and it's the same old thing every day. He was really excited about the things that he was discovering and investing in. And so that's part of what people go through is figuring out, what do you know? What are you passionate about? It could be what you've learned, what you've experience in your jobs, your education, your hobbies, you know, and you invest in the things that you're passionate about. And then we teach you how to, you know, avoid the minefields. And, you know, it is another, I think it's just a great way for people to grow the businesses that really are deserving of getting capital. And you don't have to have all the risk of doing that. And so that's, you know, that's that. So it became my mantra. And I had to create this movement to try to get more people. There's just not enough people investing in entrepreneurs. There's so many more entrepreneurs than there is money out there being invested. And it's tragic sometimes when you see something that really should be in market and there's just not enough money for it to get to market.
Karen, that brings to mind, I'd love to get your take on like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, the crowd-based funding for some of these new ideas and products and things. Where does that fit in? Is it like alongside angel investing? Is it just completely separate track? Are there different rules for that kind of stuff? What's your take on that?
Okay, so that's a great question. So there's two types, the reward and equity crowdfunding, right? So reward is Indiegogo, I think, is pretty much still there. All of those, like the ones that where you just get a product, you know, so it's
early bird discount kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right. And like even like the fidget widget, it started with reward base before it became a real product that all the crazy, everybody couldn't find them at the stores and stuff. Right. And so reward base, people gave money and they got a product. So then in 2012, they authorized four different ways to raise capital directly. The one that most people know about is what they call Reg CF. That's your equity-based crowdfunding. So that's the WeFunder, Seed Invest, Micro Invest. Kickstarter has an equity version of that. I think that is the Micro Invest. You know, so there's a lot of the of those that are equity-based. Republic is a equity-based crowdfunding, right? And that's where people put in money, and they go into, and some, it can be as small as, sometimes it's $100, $500, up $10,000, you know, as much as they want. And they get equity in that. And with Reg CF, it was the last one that became authorized by the SEC. The very first one was Reg A+, which was, and it was because there was existing rules on the books at the time. So the SEC could just tweak those and get it out there. Reg CF was all new, and they were mostly worried about the inexperienced investor investing in companies that were never going to do something. And it would be like they were just throwing their money away because they were investing on emotion. That's the biggest risk with investing in private companies, is investing on emotion. And it's very, very hard. I've made that mistake of investing on emotion sometimes, and you're like, okay, maybe someday, I don't know, these guys, as long as I'm not out of business, there's still hope, right? But it's, and so the equity, so that they had created a whole process where any platform that does equity Reg CF, they have to become FINRA approved. And FINRA is the body that's a quasi-government that legalizes broker-dealers and equity-based crowdfunding, the platforms that do that. So it's like they're licensed. So they go through a scrutiny to protect those unsophisticated investors that might be investing in it. Because the assumption is, as an accredited investor, if you got that much money, you must know enough about this stuff that if you made a bad investment and lost your money, then it's on you because, you know, got money. Sure. But if you don't have a lot of money, you may not know how to do this stuff. So right. You rely on somebody else saying it's okay. So Reg CF is that one. And last year there was about 350,000 investors that invested on the platforms in Reg CF. And then just real quick, Reg A Plus is any accredited and unaccredited, anybody can invest. You can raise up to $75 million in a year across the country. Reg CF is $5 million. And Reg A, you have to have SEC audited financials. And then most every state has what they call intrastate exemption, that you can raise up to $5 million as a company in that state, soliciting to investors in that state, accredited and unaccredited. So it's really great for community-based. And then there's the old, the traditional way of raising capital, Reg D, and they split that into a C and a B. C is direct solicitation, but you have to prove that they're accredited. So it's a little complex, but there's so many, that's why I say there's so many different ways
yeah.
to play these.
Yeah.
Well, Karen, we appreciate you coming on today. We've got a lot of information, learned a lot of things that did not know before. So that's a plus. Dakota, what's your rating on the bourbon?
I liked it. It was good. Legendary Duke. There was a burn there, but it was pretty smooth for the most part. I would like just a tad more flavor to it, I think. Just a little bit more like oomph, you know what I mean? But other than that, I think I was at like 8.9.
8.9.
You were at a 9.6, I think.
Okay. Well, we will land at a 9.3. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
And Karen, give us your thoughts on your bourbon.
Yeah. So I have from the local Atlanta distillery, ASW, Fiddler Unison. So, there you go. See it like that. And it's 90% proof. But I like... I like it. It's even. It's smooth. It's a great sipping whiskey. I don't really know how you do that whole scaling thing, but, you know, I'll throw it
in. We don't either.
Yeah, you know. I say, you know, it's got a little bit left because, you know, I savor it for special because it's tasty.
Well, good deal. Well, for all our listeners, we'd like to take this time, if maybe some of them are interested in the angel investing or getting into that type of investing, what is the best way they can get in touch with you to learn more information on that and to, you know, to, I guess, check your book out or your podcast? What's the best way for them to do that?
Probably the best way is to go to KarenRands.co, so just my name, .co, and... The book on Amazon and stuff like that. But if you go to, so my course, And I'll give a discount to your listeners.
Okay.
It's very kind of you.
Of the course, and they get the book, a digital version of it, in the course. And one of the big things about the book is that there's all these resources for investors learning how to do stuff because it's all new. Like, what do the contracts look like? What does this stuff look like? So all of that's in there. There's 25 lessons in there. And they just go to dothedeal.org, and when they put in B&B, let's just do that, B&B, all right?
Perfect.
We'll do I'll send you all the exact codes, so you can put it into the show notes, but they'll get 20% off. And there's there's already a discount if they do it annual anyway. So, but they'll get 20% off for just being a listener for that, and I appreciate it. It's I think it's a wonderful way to participate and diversify your portfolio. Yeah.
Well, Karen, thanks for coming on today, and to all our listeners. However you stream this podcast, please give us a rating and give us a follow on social media, and we'll see you next week. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode.
If you have any feedback or would like to be featured, reach out to us at bourbonandbusinesspodcast@gmail.com.
Or find us on Instagram at bourbonandbusinesspodcast.
Thanks again for listening.
Follow us for more content and info on the next episode.